On part two of our interview with Chris Arestis, we're shifting gears from retirement planning to Washington, diving into his years as a policy insider and what today's benefits advisors can learn from that intersection of politics, advocacy, and the future of our industry. Let's get into it.
Welcome, and thank you for joining us for Healthcare Happy Hour, the official podcast of the National Association of Benefits and Insurance Professionals.
And I'm your host, David Saltzman. Chris Arestis is back with us. We had a great talk about long-term care and retirement planning and whatnot in our previous segment. But as I said in the open, we're going to talk about something that Chris also has great depth and expertise at, which is Washington and working with different organizations, and a lot that we at NABIP can learn from his background. So Chris, thanks for sticking around for part two.
Oh, I'm glad we have a chance to do a part two.
You spent years working in Washington with organizations like AHIP and ACLI, as well as inside the White House and on Capitol Hill. What originally drew you into policy, and how did you get from healthcare, from there to healthcare?
Well, I grew up in politics. I have a family background in the political environment of Maine, my home state. And when I got out of college, I was working on campaigns, and that opened the door to going to Washington, D.C., right at the time that a new president was being inaugurated, and I had an opportunity to go and be part of the transition team as a new president was being seated. And then from there, I went to Capitol Hill, where I was able to work in the Senate Majority Leader's office for Senator George Mitchell from my home state of Maine. And I had the privilege of doing that for about 2 or 3 years until he retired. And then I went from Capitol Hill to working for the trade associations that represent the insurance industry. So at the time, AHIP was actually HIAA, the Health Insurance Association of America. And I went there and I worked there for a number of years as a lobbyist and senior vice president of the organization. And then for my last couple of years in D.C. before I left, I worked for the ACLI, the American Council of Life Insurers. And in the early 2000s, post-9/11, made a family decision that we wanted to move back to Maine to raise a young family. And that's when I took my political background and my exposure, experience, and interest in what we were covering in Washington, D.C. to the private sector and started a business that was focused on helping families access funding to pay for senior care, long-term care living, assisted living, nursing homes, that kind of thing. Because that had been an issue area where I had spent a bunch of time in Washington working between the trade groups that I was with, and then building coalitions with other organizations. We worked with our fellow organizations that were in the insurance space that represented the agents, such as NAHIP, NAHU at the time, and then partnering also with the groups that were representing the nursing homes, the assisted living communities, because there was a heavy focus. This was the 90s going into the early 2000s. On the coming baby boomer population aging into retirement. And interesting how back then, which unfortunately I realized to be a long time ago, it doesn't seem like it. Seems like it was just yesterday. I think all of us suffer from that problem. We were looking way down the road that, you know, the baby boomers are going to start turning 65 in years in the future. We got to get ready. And we were doing a lot of policy work around long-term care insurance, life insurance, annuities, that all was heading in the same place of how can we use the private sector, private pay solutions to help better ensure financial security and then dealing with the reality of the costs of aging and declining health as people move towards the need for long-term care, knowing that programs like Social Security, Medicaid, Medicare would become quite stressed. and were already stressed that back then. But looking back compared to where we are now to then, that was the good old days, to where we are today with the programs and even more potential budget cuts on the horizon in those areas. So the intersection of demographic realities of an aging population, what that does economically to this country, we're a vastly different country when it comes to the demographic profile than we were 20 and 30 years ago. And then the political reaction to that and the political imperatives that come from placing where your priorities are as a nation, because the dollar has to hit the road. We're paying for something. And where is your money going? That really starts to become the big tug of war right now. The realities of where our country is and how much money do we have to work.
Is that the big change in the policy environment from when you were in D.C. to today? Is it mostly a question of priorities and how you split up the dollars?
Yeah, well, particularly now, because remember, in the 90s, when I was still working on Capitol Hill, we were passing balanced budgets. We had balanced budgets for 3 years of the 90s. Clinton was president. Gingrich was Speaker of the House. And they worked together in a bipartisan fashion to do something quite radical, balancing a budget, lowered spending, and increased income through taxes to balance a budget. And we had 3 years in a row of balanced budgets, so the priorities were very much aligned, even though the politics weren't, but the differences in the politics between a Clinton and a Gingrich to where we find ourselves today is, you could almost look at them as all being members of the exact same party compared to where we are today. The ability to work in a bipartisan nature, to align priorities with spending, income, how you're going to pay for it, is just a much different, just 20 and 30 years ago, how different it was. And in fact, if you had said to me, if you had laid out where we are today, what we are currently experiencing politically and fiscally in this country, I would have said you're describing a science fiction movie that could never possibly exist. Yet here we are, and we have quite a challenge ahead of us to once again align our priorities, our spending, and try and find some common ground politically that used to exist, that has really been almost eradicated from our country today.
You're the Region 1 PAC chair, which means that you're frequently out amongst the members, and you've worked both inside government and as a lobbyist. What's something that most people, including our members, may misunderstand about how healthcare and insurance policy actually gets shaped?
Well, a big part of it is that none of this happens overnight. In fact, the debates, many of the debates we're having are the same debates with just a couple of little tweaks and some different names and players when I was there 20, 30 years ago. In fact, I remember we were digging through some archives from the old HIAA before it became AHIP. And we were finding policy papers and testimony that had been delivered in the 40s and 50s. And as we read through it, we said, we're still talking about much of the same stuff. And so it is an ongoing discussion that isn't solved by attending one CapCon and going to one fly-in. You don't do that, go home, and then look in the paper the next day to see the impact, the changes that made. It is a commitment that has to be sustained. It, quite frankly, somebody once made a good analogy. You know, politics and policy, like healthcare in particular, is kind of like painting the Golden Gate Bridge. as soon as you're done painting it and you've gotten to one side, you got to go back and start painting it again. It's a never-ending process. So the role that NABIT plays and the members of NABIT play and the leadership of NABIT and the state chapters and the PAC and I've been to the last two CapCons and had interacted with previous CapCons in years past when I used to run those kind of things when I was a young staffer coming out. We'd do fly-ins and those kinds of things. It is very important, even though you aren't going to get an email the next day telling you about the changes in policy, know that you're having an impact and that NABIP's having an impact and that these things are important, but you have to sustain them. You can't just pop up for a minute, dabble in this, go away, and think that you're going to be able to solve this. This is an ongoing process, and NABIP has been a very effective player in it.
Beyond persistence, and that certainly is important, what separates, broadly speaking, effective advocacy groups from those that struggle to make an impact?
Well, it's the commitment of the members. And I see a very committed membership base when it comes to NABIP. You know, when you're turning out close to 1,000 people showing up at CapCon, that's impressive. When you see the kind of activity that goes on at the state level, when you see the participation in the PAC so that there's funds to be able to be at the table, because our political system is fueled by political contributions, and you need to be a player at the table. And having an active, committed base of members who are contributing, not just financially, but with their participation, with their voice, that really is the difference that is between success and not being successful when it comes to this game. And in many ways, this is a game, it's an art, it's a science that all comes together. And I have observed NABIP to be very effective at it. And the insurance industry, going back now all my years as being part of it, as being very effective, because one thing that's very consistently known is that the agents, the advisors, are part of the community. They live in the community. This isn't some random corporate, nameless, faceless entity. This is people that are in your town. Members of Congress went to school with these people, grew up with these people. They know these people are in the town, in the community. And that has a big impact, knowing you're dealing with people that live in your community, employ people in your community, are generating income in their community, and helping others in the community with such important things like health and life insurance coverage.
Well, that's a great lead into the next question, which is, a lot of our fellow NABIP members are client-facing advisors. How should they be thinking about policy changes, not just as compliance issues, but in opportunities that they can better serve their clients?
Well, this is the real world. You know, this is where the agents who are working with their clients, it's the cross-section of policy, because Washington, D.C., and even state level government policy, because remember, the state level has such a huge impact on what happens to our industry. Well, it's not just Washington, it's in the states. Happens at the policy level, the political level, translates into real lives. You have a real impact on what you're doing from whatever the playing field is set for you to how that translates into impacting somebody's financial and health security going forward into their life, and your ability to be an effective advocate and agent for your clients. So understanding the policy, understanding the issues is important, understanding the importance that politics plays and being involved in it, because it has a real impact, not just on your business, but on your clients and on your community, is important. And I've had people say to me, you know what, I don't really care about politics. I ignore politics. And I say, well, you may not care and you may ignore it, but I can tell you something. politics cares about you, and politics is not ignoring you. So either understand what's going on around you. If you bury your head in the sand, you're not going to be as effective as somebody who is paying attention, who is understands what the political policy impacts are on their business and how that translates into what they're doing for their clients, versus the person who tries to ignore it and just, I just sell my product and I don't care about anything but selling my product. Goes back to what we were talking about being a well-rounded, well-balanced advisor from having as full a toolbox as you can have. Well, it's also being a well-informed and intelligent advisor by understanding the policy framework that you're operating in as well.
So as we talked about in part one of our interview, you're a major voice in long-term care. Why has it been so difficult for policymakers, to create sustainable solutions in that space? And should it be policymakers who are creating those solutions? I know there are some public-private partnerships.
Yeah, you know, there's the role that the private sector plays, and there's the role that the public sector plays. Certainly, Medicare, Medicaid, ACA are critical public sector solutions. They are a part of the puzzle. Private sector solutions that come from the insurance industry, from financial advisory services, you need the rules of the road. So regulation and compliance are key. But as soon as politicians try to operate as business people, you can get less than desirable outcome. It's always interesting. You'll always hear this idea of, well, I want a business person to run the country or run politics like a business. But ultimately what we have seen over the years is that business people make lousy politicians, and oftentimes politicians make lousy business people, because those are two almost opposite skill sets. You know, you can't CEO command a political world, and in a business environment, you need top-down command. Versus what many politicians are trained to do is work committee processes, find collaboration, operate over a long period of time with slow incremental change. These are two very different things. And so to find the balance where they operate together in a harmonious way is going to be much better than where one is overly trying to influence itself on the other. Political will trying to impose itself too much on the business sector will oftentimes create unintended consequences that can't be anticipated. And because it takes so long for things to be developed, to be enacted, to be rolled out, you make a mistake, you can't, unlike a business, decide to just pull the plug on something. You're going to have a long unwind to fix and get back to something that works.
From where you're sitting, what are policymakers still getting wrong today when it comes to healthcare and retirement or aging issues?
Well, I think oftentimes it is dealing with conflicting priorities, because you have what your constituents need, but then you have what your stakeholders need. And by stakeholders, I mean the businesses, the political supporters. And oftentimes those things are not necessarily aligned. It's hard to find the balance of satisfying the political stakeholders to the constituents, to the citizenry, those that lean too heavily in one direction or another and can't find the balance between those. Again, I'm coming back to balance. Politics is so much about balance. That's where we start to run into problems. When you're off balance, you're leaning too far. And I don't mean too far to the right or too far to the left. I mean too far to serving one constituency, but not listening to another, and then missing the mark, and then putting yourself in a position where something goes forward that can do harm unintendedly most often, and then take a very long time to unwind and get back in place again.
What would you say to benefits professionals who feel like they don't have a voice in shaping policy?
You have a voice if you are willing to use it. You have a platform with NABIP and possibly other organizations you may be involved in where you can get involved. And so it's like a tool. You're going to get out of a tool what you put into it. So you're going to get out of an organization what you put into it. And I certainly have seen effective and involved members of NABIP at CapCon and that I've had the opportunity to engage with where they're involved and they've got a voice and they're always asking for more voices to join the chorus. The louder and more harmonious of a chorus NABIP can bring together at the federal level and at the state levels, the more effective it's going to be. So anybody has a voice if they're willing to use it, and the platforms and tools are there at their disposal if they're willing to reach out and take them. And again, you may think that you're not interested in politics, but politics is interested in you. Politics' hand is in your pocket, and a matter of, do you want to be at the table and have a voice and be have some input to what happens, or are you going to just wait to see what happens and find out what happened to you?
Like they say, you can be at the table or you can be on the menu. You know, as I mentioned a little while ago, you serve on NABIP's PAC board. How important is political engagement and PAC participation for our future as brokers and advisors?
It's very important. Number one, political spending is considered part of free speech. That's part of the ability to exercise free speech. I am not a proponent of the idea that you're buying influence, but I am a proponent of the idea that you're buying a ticket to get in the room and have an opportunity to make your case, build relationships, be in the discussion, be at the table. And the American political system runs on donations, and those that can organize their people, organize their voice, and organize their resources, which include PAC spending, PAC dollars, are going to be more effective. You can't buy a championship, but you can spend money smartly to put all the pieces in place to compete for and get to and maybe win a championship. And that's what a PAC is. It's not that you're going to buy policy, but it's putting you in a position to have the team, the access to talk to those people that are making the decisions, making the policy, and be known, be recognized as a valuable resource and be there.
You know, I've been to all but two of the Capitol conferences since they started. Yes, I am that old. And one of the questions that always comes up at Capitol conference is, how important are in-district visits? I know we can go up on the Hill and we can meet sometimes with the legislator, sometimes with their staff. Are in-district visits equally important or more important, or does it give you a better opportunity to kind of create a friendship, if you will, with the legislator?
In-district is so important and it's so impactful. You're just going to have that much more access and recognition and ability to build a relationship, like you say, at the district level versus the DC level. I would almost look at the DC level as, you know, the CapCon is your Super Bowl, and all year long, you got to play the games. You got to be on the field. And that's really going to be happening for the members. That's really going to be happening in district. You have NABIP staff in DC that are doing their thing, but it's the work that's done at the district and the value of the dollars that are spent in the district. That's another thing. You know, a $1,000 check given at an event in Washington, D.C. does the same value as a $1,000 check given at an event or used to help build and host an event where you invite others and raise more money in district. So the in-district work and the state chapters are critical.
One last question. If you were advising your fellow NABIP members directly, what should they be paying closest attention to over the next, say, 3 to 5 years at that intersection of policy, healthcare, and retirement?
Well, NABIP, because so much of the policy emphasis is around Medicare and ACA and the impact that Medicaid has on that, NABIP's going to be front and center because the debate about entitlements, funding entitlements, entitlement reform. I mean, we're looking at, in less than 10 years, Medicare and Social Security's trust funds being insolvent. And there's going to need to be some major adjustments made, again, to that concept of what do you do on spending, but what do you do on income to find balance? You're not going to cut your way to the solution, and you're not going to just fund your way to the solution. There's going to have to be both happening, and that's a debate really that will start in earnest after 2028. We've got the midterm election coming up this year, and then it's a two-year run to the next presidential election. It'll be at that point. Once we get to 2028, you're looking at about a five-year window to insolvency. Now the clock is going to be ticking very loud, and I think NABIP's going to be an important voice in what's going to happen around those discussions for how do we shore up these programs, get them right to reflect where we are demographically, economically, and politically as a country today.
Chris Orestes, president of Retirement Genius. Chris, thank you for a fascinating conversation, and thanks for serving as Region 1 PAC chair.
Happy to be a member of NABIP, happy to be on the PAC board, and happy to be with you today.
You can have the Healthcare Happy Hour podcast downloaded automatically by subscribing on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. You can also find a link to the podcast in the member-exclusive Washington Update, published on Fridays. For more information on our government affairs efforts or to become a member, visit nabip.org.